6, no. When I was a sophomore, a second-year student in university, I took a course called College Algebra on the computer. A room far larger than this had all those vacuum tube computers with all the tapes running, and we had to have key punch cards. 20 problems for the entire semester, but every single step. And of course, if one step was out of order, it was fatal error. I can send you the PowerPoints. I'll send you the PowerPoints. I have some small print up there, so you have to have glasses like mine to be able to always read everything. I tell students that. I try to sneak on too much. And
that is...
Yeah, it'll work. Okay.
The irony of it was that one forwards and that one puts it back. Those two buttons there.
This one's forward.
No, that one's forward.
Oh.
It's reverse logic. It's to keep you thinking.
Okay.
Well, you can do it that way. I say, it's the first person to work that one out. If you turn it upside down, it's the logic.
Life has been that way. The first time I ever went to Thailand, I was on an airplane flying from Calcutta after spending 5 weeks in India and flying on to Tokyo. The plane set down, was there for an hour at the airport, and took off. And I remember being there, and the airplane had evacuation of about 80% of the passengers. All the passengers getting off were either Thai or Indian, and those coming on the plane were mostly Japanese, as we were going on to Tokyo. Tourists. That was my first impression of Thailand. I said, oh, a lot of tourists here. It is going to work? Not backwards, though, I guess. Okay. There we are. Okay. Well, the story begins, actually it begins in 1989. The Baptist General Conference opened up Thailand as a new mission field. And two couples were appointed to go there the following year. The first couple, Steve and Noplak Cable, she being the Thai, the daughter of a pastor, a Thai Baptist pastor, was probably instrumental in helping that field to be opened. And then also we have the Waltons. The Waltons and the Cables met at Bethel Theological Seminary, a seminary in suburban St. Paul in Minnesota. And they had a heart for Asians. Steve Cable had worked in a Cambodian church. He had actually started a Cambodian church. Laotian Church at Bethlehem Baptist, where John Piper has served as pastor. And the Waltons started a Hmong church in Calvary Baptist in Roseville. It's the church we go to. What else do we have there? Okay, their language study, of course, she needed none. But her husband, Steve needed language study, as did Kevin and Cynthia. And for 2 years, while studying language, and they invested two solid years studying in language school and also working in the initial Baptist church that was planted. By the way, that church was started in the early 80s. And Noplak's father had actually received a Master of Divinity and then a Doctor of Ministry from Bethel Seminary as well. Let's see. I'm supposed to do this.
Correct.
Okay. After 2 years, they move out to Bankipi, a northeastern suburb. And this northeastern suburb's amazing. Bankipi has two universities. One university has only about 400,000 plus students. And the Cables, they envision once they get going and they find a place to worship, they lease a building. And they said, we have to have a place to meet. And they were renting apartments that were far too small to have much of a group in them. So they leased a building. It was maybe all of three and a half meters wide and very long and skinny, four stories. And bathroom, a loo on the main floor and a loo on the third floor. Not exactly the most convenient facility, but they were in a poor area. It was very well located, about five blocks from a large mall, two blocks away from a water taxi. Consequently, it was a good location to try to start a ministry. And I've got to see what I put there. Yes. They each had a vision. You have to understand, Steve's father as both a pastor as well as a school teacher. And Noplik had not only received a bachelor's from a university in Thailand, but a master's of English from the University of Minnesota and a master's from seminary at Bethel Seminary. So consequently, education is something that they valued. And they had a real heart for the student world. They wanted to reach the students of Thailand. The Waltons, on the other hand, had a different vision. And this is hard when missionaries are thrown together and they have different visions. And they wanted to reach the poor. Kevin Walton was the nephew of a nearly 40-year-long missionary to India, who lived in central India working among the Korku tribe. And he spent a year there with his aunt and fell in love with the poor. His wife had also gone to the Philippines for a year, and she'd worked with the poor. And they had a vision for the poor. But the two of them said, we will work together and we'll reach the poor in the area and we'll reach the student world. It's going to turn. Noplik immediately wanted to start a conversational English school. She wanted to put that master's degree to work. She realized that in Thailand, huge city, a lot of the university students were taking English as a part of their curriculum, but they could not speak it hardly at all. And when they spoke it, the accent was so hard. They needed conversational English. They did not need the grammar. They could read Shakespeare, but they couldn't speak it. But her husband didn't want to. He felt that this was, and he didn't use the term, it's not vulnerable mission. But he basically said, no, we're in Thailand. We function in Thai. But we can start a computer school. So they started a computer school. And that went for several years until people realized that you really don't need to go to school to learn how to use a computer. You have to turn it on and start pushing buttons. But as that school died, they started an English language school. But it had a rough beginning. At the same time, you had the Waltons, who had an amazing vision. Yes. They started going around and meeting the poor. They found out that there were shoe menders on the sidewalk who had to travel for 2 hours on a bus each way, on buses each way, to buy their supplies. So he said, oh, they should be sold locally. So in one of the small rooms, he went and bought a lot of supplies and said, when you need your supplies, come. We have a shop, and we'll sell them to you at cost. We don't want to make money, but there was one of the early Christians. They had a few people who were sent out from Noplik's father's church to help them, and he said, this will be my ministry. He was an older man, and I'll just manage the shop. And they found out that others needed certain supplies that weren't local, so they started this little shop. They started a daycare. The daycare did not work. The poor do not use daycare. But the shoe supply shop continues to this day. Started reaching out to the food vendors. Many of the food vendors are quite poor, but they're honest, hardworking people. and they saw men and women come to Christ. They saw a children growing, and they saw a children's ministry. They saw all these things happening. But at the same time, there were students coming to the computer school. There were students coming to the then English language school, and the church started to get very full. And they leased a second and then a third building and knocked out all the walls. And they were growing. It was in 98 when I went there with a group of students, and they asked us to come for just 10 days to understand what they're doing. I'd met Steve Cable, actually. He came by the school and visited, and he's the one who invited us. So we went. And the women all stayed in their center. They had a couple rooms that were air-conditioned. I stayed with a few of the early Christians in that church in their apartment, and I was humbled, and I cried. I'd never stayed in absolute slums. And it didn't bother me that there was no air conditioning and that there wasn't even a fan. What bothered me is that I felt so demanding. I wanted to have a flush toilet. And they had an outhouse that was connected to plumbing, but it was apart from the building. And I thought, oh my. Because just a few blocks away was a mall. Four-story mall with a water park on the top floor. And I said, there's such disparity. But you have these two churches that were really one church but growing together. And the second time we went there the following year, we had an outreach. It was around Thanksgiving, and we had an American Thanksgiving outreach to these English-speaking students and also the youth who were coming, the youth of the slum families who also came. And that was a hard, hard experience. By the way, I'm not reading my paper. You'll get my paper. It was a hard experience to see, you know, the combining of these groups. They didn't always mix. But yet, at the same time, we had a room that was three times the size of the original room that was packed. And we're all sitting on the floor, and my students, were they creative? They wanted to tell the story. They wanted us to explain the story of Thanksgiving, and my students had the Puritans arriving on surfboards. And I mean, it was an American folly. But at the same time, they said it was the first time they'd reached the 150 mark ever in their facility. I thought, wow, this is an unusual church. And then you saw these older, very poor people, poor men and women who were there as well. Well, this church continues on, and the Baptist Central Conference in the Philippines had been planting churches in Cebu for a number of years, and they had a seminary there, and the Philippines decided to adopt that as a missions field. And so they started sending native English speakers, Philippine English speakers, to assist the school. And first they'd come for 9 months, but two individuals, Ethel right now has gone back to the Philippines, but she has been serving there all those years. And in fact, she this past year was the director, the assistant director of the Santisuk English School. But that's another story. It was no longer an ownership of American missionaries. At the same time, you have these two churches developing, sharing one facility, and it's not doing well. Because sometimes the language school, which always had priority over the facilities, because they had paying students, and so something happened. They divide. Peace Community Church continues to stay where they are. Two-thirds of the people who are active are a part of that group. And only one-third leave and form Peace Fellowship Church, about maybe 2 kilometers away. Not that far away. They rent a facility at first, and then eventually they buy one. And the language school really finally takes off because it is no longer on an isolated location off a side soy. It's right on a major, Ladparao, which is a major boulevard, and it's very visible. This is what Kevin Walton had to say. I have to read this. He said, when rice plants' shoots come up too close when sprouting, they're pulled up and replanted further apart to give the greater harvest. Likewise, two missionary families needed to separate so they would not choke each other out, but rather have room to grow to their full potential. And I looked at and I listened to that, and I wrote it down, and I realized there were two ministries growing, one to the student world and to businessmen who were coming to the language school as well. But reaching the poor, the two of them did not mix. At first, what identified these people is they were seeking for truth, and they came to know Jesus Christ, but ultimately, socially, they didn't mix. The church, the original church was a cell church, reaching out to your social group. So you had cells of the poor, and you had cells of the student world. Both churches continued on in the cell church model. And here you see what's going on. The English school is very successful. It eventually gets accreditation by the government. They produce a number of textbooks that become the standard for a lot of any type of Christian outreach using English school as a means. Their textbook, loaded with Bible stories, and discussion in the classroom, and they're seeing up 1 year they saw 19 baptisms out of those students. And in Thailand, that's revival. That's almost a people movement. And they have been successful. And they continue to have more cells. The members are in charge. The school is entirely self-sufficient. It's paying all its staff members. It rents their use of the facility, but the money is not used by the church. It's used for mission outreach, and they have one member down, and one of the members is in Vietnam. One of the members is now in Myanmar doing missions work, and that's supported by the English school. So it's actually accomplished something that is kind of exciting. And the Cables are now in a new church about over by the international airport, and they're starting. They're working in a ministry that was actually started by Filipinos and who are now home for I think 3 years, working on a graduate degree, and they're starting all over again in some ways. But the original church is now totally self-sufficient. They had one student go to the Baptist Seminary in Bangkok. Another couple went to Azusa Pacific University. He'd received an offer of doing a master's degree there, and they studied. And they are now in this pastoral leadership. What's happened to our church there, as you read, they had these four cell groups. Now, the one cell group was meeting at the church. Those are the older members that they had reached originally. The food vendors, the shoe cobblers, repairmen, really. They had one meeting in a slum. They had two that were very gathered. They're meeting in different parts of Bunkapi. But really, one was reaching the poor, one was reaching in a slum, but two of them were reaching working class people. I wouldn't call them poor, but they had been a part of the church since the beginning, and they didn't feel they wanted to join the other group. The sad thing is that ultimately something happens. 2005. Kevin Walton came back to the States, and a new missionary had been appointed to go to Thailand in 2003, had gone through language study, and he was assigned to take over Kevin's work while he was gone. And then he informs Kevin after a few months, I will be here as long as you're home on your home assignment, but I do not feel called to work with low-income families. It crushed Kevin because he really said he thought he needed some help. He couldn't do it all himself. And he can't. Reaching the slums is too much for one person. And he and his wife worked hard. So while he was on his home assignment, he was quite depressed. In fact, I know that this isn't in my paper, Northwestern College, as it was called back then, received a resume from him. He was willing to teach sociology. He was willing to teach just about anything. He just didn't feel that he was making any progress because the church had reached a peak. It was seeing some growth, but not really because he was running it. What can he do? So, ultimately, he said, we're going to have to change. We can't be church-centered. We can't be missionary-centered. I have got to learn to be a missionary coach. I can't be the pastor. Isn't that interesting? Moving from church planter at the beginning, I'm the pastor. And so he says, we're going to go to house church movement. And originally, the cell churches met on a weekly basis, and about every other week they'd meet together. And he said, we're going to have the house churches meet every week, and then one Sunday evening we'll meet in that center. The older people who had their cell group before meeting and they all lived fairly close to their, what they called the center, their church building, continued to meet there, and they had no problem. The one that was in the slum was not having a problem. In fact, they finally took off. And one of the elders in that church, who was, by the way, the janitor at the English-speaking school, and his wife was the bookkeeper for the conversational. They were living in the slum. They didn't have a lot of income. And by the way, slums are not determined just by income. Slums are people who don't have enough to buy land, and there are squatters on land, and they build their houses on that land. And whoever owns the land can someday decide, I want this land. So they never, even if people have some money, they'll not invest it in buildings because they're going to lose their buildings. But that one took off. It was growing. It was the most growing one. The one at the center, it was a little bit stagnant, but the other two absolutely fell apart. And they scattered. And some of them in that group ended up going back to Noplick's parents' church because they had actually originally come from that church. Kevin really became depressed. He did not know what to do. He's had over a 50% decline in size of his congregation. And he's seeing the cables work grow and grow and see more and more baptisms. And he said he's happy for them, but he didn't know what to do. Well, a little earlier than that, and I think I can get here. Well, in 2003, he'd made contact with Servant Partners, a group in Pomona, California, one of the number of new mission movements that are community movements. They try very hard to have a group live in community and to work among the poor in various nations. This one was started through InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, part of IFES, and he made contact, and they had some workers come. This was when just right after they'd come together. But the first group that was there just paved the way. The first year in a part, they're really studying the language. They live in the slums. They tried to identify with the people. But it was not until the second group came that they started to see something happen. Now, we're in a Baptist church, and I know I'm standing just in front of the baptistry. Having served in Baptist churches, I have to say I like a baptistry with water in it. because it says God's working. God's bringing people to Christ. In my very first pastorate, if there was one person who came to know Christ and wanted to be baptized and they really had a true conversion, I was very quick in filling the baptistry because I wanted people to be obedient. I wanted people to demonstrate their faith. But when Kevin had no baptisms for several years, that was defeating. So what happened was ultimately the servant partners in working in that area, working with the elders, and then moving on, and now having replaced those two that were lost with two new house churches in different slums, he's beginning to see something happen, and baptisms took off. I'm going to have to read something here. Yeah, the new structure that he had was weekly gatherings of the local community, discipleship during the week taking place in the house churches, and visibly working in the community. Now, Kevin said an interesting thing. He says he believes that the urban poor are probably easier to reach than most the urban poor who live in Bangkok, greater Bangkok, not in the slums, are the easiest to reach with the gospel. They don't have a lot of material things that get in the way. But he says then something else happens. He says if they live in a slum, there's this group think. And people come from the outside and they're do-gooders. And they do all these good things coming into the slums and handing out things. But he said the conversion within the slums is very, very slow. He said, but by moving to the house churches, all of a sudden, they were no longer outsiders coming in. Their house churches were churches in the slums. Kevin then went so far as to build. Actually, he found some land, and he and a couple of his members built him a two-room house there. And he had children, and his wife said, and she was homeschooling. They'd been in school, and they were getting ready to go back to the United States to university, and they wanted to get them. And so she was homeschooling the last 2 years of high school. And then she says, well, that's good. You homeschool. I'm going to live in the slums. You come to the slums on weekends so you can participate. And the whole family was staying in this two-room apartment. And the rest of the time they went back because she was homeschooling, and she needed to do that. But he really identified as becoming a part of that. What has happened is Kevin moved away from being pastor. The elders became pastors of the group. And the elders take turns preaching when they have celebration of their house churches. They've gone up to six and they're back to four. And they know that the house churches in the slums are fragile. They meet in the homes. But he also knows, he was sharing with me, he said, John, if I go back to America, if we had to go back, I know that there are going to be four churches left. Now, the building that they are leasing right now, the lease comes up, I believe, in 2015 and 2016, respectively, on their properties. And I ask him, well, what are you going to do? He says, I'm not doing anything. He says, that's the church's decision. And they have already come to the decision that they don't need as much building as they had before. They probably could still rent one of those facilities because they have the Santee Sukh Fund. The Santee Sukh Fund is a fund to help the poor. And yes, they have microloans. And where do the funds come from? Well, the funds come from Peace Community Church, Peace Fellowship Church, and the other two there are other two churches that have been started in the Bangkok area by the mission, and in addition to Pastor Harthan's church as well. And so they get funding, and they give out these loans. They have, in one particular community, if you can imagine, there was a slum that the government said, we're going to move you out of this area. We need this land. And then they completely bulldozed the area, and the project fell through, but these people had been forced to leave. In the process, the Santi Sukh Fund charity had basically worked and empowered these people. There are about 30 families total in that area, to buy some land where they could become an actual community. Now, they're former slum dwellers, and they have still that same mentality of this is our group thing. But would you believe that there are 11 families, 11 families that are Christians that are a part of it. It's made quite a difference. He realizes that he now has a sustainable model. A sustainable model is planting churches within the slums. He will work with Thai. He will assist Thai, but he will not do anything by himself. Now, this term, I believe we're toward the end. Yes. Yeah. He went back his last term, and he asked his church what he should be doing for them. And they said to him, we'd like to get to know other churches in the slums. And so he's networking now with other churches. Other churches that are working in slums, planting house churches. Had he not done that, had he continued to stay in that cell group model, and he went home, there would be no more churches in the slums when he would retire or leave. So when we talk about a sustainable model for reaching the slums, transformational from being a very traditional-minded church that you have a building and you come to that building, it was centered around one missionary's effort. And now it's a group of Thai believers who carry that. I can go on, and I'm not reading the paper. As I said, you'll get that. It's very academic with about 30, 40 footnotes in this paper. But do you have any questions?
What is the sort of demographics of the Thailand? I know it's Buddhist. How does that impact the work?
Okay. Buddhism arrived in Thailand in four waves. From Sri Lanka, it came from India, it came, a second wave came from India, and then a third wave came from Myanmar, or Burma. It has been Buddhist. Catholics came about 450 years ago. They made friends with the king, they were given land, and eventually they were kicked out as well. But they came back. 1820 is when Protestant missionaries came. It took 20 years for the first converts to really develop. Today it's 1% Christian, 200 churches in Bangkok for a city of about 18 million. Largely Buddhist, growing Muslim population. The southern part of Thailand is Muslim, and they're moving up to Bangkok. And they're all very visible. Mosques are always found near highways. You see these mosques. Along the water taxi, there's a mosque, I think, about every fourth stop. Christians are few in number. You have a united Protestant church there that is lukewarm at best and not very strong spiritually. In the past, there have been various movements, but a lot of fragmentation among the various denominations. But spiritually, it is a country that is largely Buddhist. And I'm not going to say heavily engaged Buddhist, but they are Buddhist in foundation, in worldview. How does one reach Buddhists in that situation? How do you reach them in Cambodia? I think it's the love of Christ that reaches out. It's not going to be our reasoning. It's not going to be using our apologetic skills. My definition of good apologetics is pointing people to Jesus. Because quite honestly, arguments, we can win arguments all the time theologically, but we don't win converts. The cell church movement in the Cables Church is a marvelous example of that. Students start studying English. The teachers sometimes would say, oh, what are you doing Sunday morning? Because Sunday morning is when they have their cell groups. And no one's working on Sunday morning usually, and their students, and, well, come to cell group. And cell groups have fun, games, singing, a little bit of message, not a lot, but they're for outreach. And then all of a sudden, they're saying, oh, would you like to practice your English? On Friday night, they don't say on Friday night we have a Thai service. On Sunday evening, we have an English service, and you can practice your English free. Well, they come, but they have a duplicate service of it as far as the message, but it's in Thai on Friday nights. They start coming to the English service. Now, they're not understanding a lot, but they enjoy the music because they do a really great job with music. And they have retreats. They'll have various things, and people slowly come to know to make a decision to follow Jesus Christ. The cell church works there. The house church works, and I attended one of the house churches that Kevin brought me to. I could not believe that this little house, a room that could sit in the living room, all where you're sitting could probably be about the size. There must have been about 50 of us in that room. A lot of children. And they scattered out. And they had one large room, and they had two small rooms attached to it as well. So it was a three-room house. The kitchen was one wall of it. And of course, people sleep on mats at night, so it all becomes one large bedroom. But when people come to the difference between the house church is that the house church did not have the fun and activities. It was not as attractive. The house church immediately they'd start out with a few songs, and then they really said, "What do we need to pray for?" And they would spend a long time in prayer. And you would have people who were brought, neighbors who were brought, and maybe one didn't have a job, and another one was diagnosed with cancer, and they literally took time to pray. And consequently, the house churches are very significant in reaching out to the needs there. But the spiritual climate of Thailand, very, very Buddhist. If you take the entire number of Christians and subtract the ethnic minority Karen, you've lost maybe 75% of the Christian population in Thailand. Because you have the Karen who have come over from Myanmar, escaping and now they're coming to America in large number. We're seeing a large immigration of Karen to America. Other questions?
But actually, they're not getting it free.
as far as they're paying. And I don't consider the fees high. I thought they were cheap, but I was told that the fees were very significant. And all the Thai who have studied their bachelor's and even master's in English are teaching in the school. When I take students actually to Thailand, and we are in the Cables Church, and for 1 month we become the teachers. My students become the teachers, and it allows their teachers to go have a retreat and to prepare for the following year and to do just staff training, and we relieve them that way. I only do that every other year, so obviously they don't have that same opportunity all the time. Are they buying? Well, for the fact that I would say it's less than 1%, it's probably seven-tenths of a percent who have come to Christ. No, I don't think they're buying very many converts. The ones who have come to Christ, and the church has not had a lot of transfer growth either. Their growth has pretty much come from their outreach program. Most of the individuals who have studied English have studied it because they have jobs that required English, and they were not doing, a lot of them were not doing well in their conversational English. Now, it's interesting, they have now the Filipino missionaries receive part of their support in the Philippines, and part of their salary comes from the students' tuition. You can argue it both ways. That's not the church that I was really presenting, but I have to present both of them. Because I think to reach the Thai, you're not going to reach just the slums. And you have to reach, people will reach different classes and different groups. The difficulty with that, though, is that you have two very, very distinct churches, 2 miles apart. A mile and a half apart. And they do get together. By the way, they get together probably about every 3 months. They will have joint baptisms. They'll go down. In fact, not just those two churches. There might be another church as well. And they will go down to the ocean and have a baptism. But does it have a risk? I think. And as long as the Cables were in charge, as long as they were there, as long as he was, quote, the pastor, it was very tenuous. But when the church took on its own leadership and is paying for its own leadership, sending out missionaries, granted, it's from the funds from the rent from the schools, but it's very exciting to see that they're doing that. I think the church is a viable church today. It is, by the way, their language school is one of the most popular language schools in the Bangkok area because they really have good English teachers, and they said they have a friendly program. It's interesting, they have all these different levels, but some students will be in the same level for up to a year, repeating every month. And they'll be repeating because they cannot speak it, but by the time they've actually gone through the four grades, the four levels, they're fairly conversant in English. So they're known for their excellence. They said that they will be a language school to teach excellent English, be an excellent English school, and not just be there so that they can get people in to convert them. They want to demonstrate that this is why they're there. But yet, it has been very much a way of bringing Christ. My students read through the Bible stories, and they read these Bible study stories in class, and the students discuss the healing of blind Bartimaeus. And they like Jesus. And they said, well, yeah, we have stories like that. But then they point out on a map, well, this happened in, they show, this is just outside of Jericho. And this is a place, over in, you mean this has actually happened? This is historical? And so you're having students, university students, who are actually in the evening program, they have a lot of businessmen who come. And I ask, well, are the businessmen, is that wasted time, wasted money? they had one woman who came who was a businesswoman who was just really, really aggressive. She was Chinese, ethnic Chinese, very aggressive. And every time they'd have activities, she'd come and she'd always have a young woman with her, she was very much into a lesbian lifestyle. They were not critical about that. They did not see that that was the thing to be critical. But as she came into that and she started understanding what was going on, she says, well, what is sin? And the Thai don't understand sin too well at first. They do understand karma, but sin is a different word. There came a point when she committed her life to Christ. There came a point when she abandoned her lesbian lifestyle. She says, I don't need that anymore. And her mother, this is a businesswoman who was in her 40s, her mother came with her one time to a dinner. And she said, I don't know what you do here, but my daughter is now my daughter. She wanted to be my son. And now she's my daughter. And the mother said, I need to know what you do here. Now, that's kind of exciting. We're not talking about masses, and I don't think that the church grows by masses in places like Thailand, nor in England, for that matter. But yet, the Holy Spirit's been able to convict and to convert. No, not at all. Because after the tsunami in Pangna in the south, they started a ministry down there, and the person who went down there, a Thai graduate of the Baptist Seminary, he wanted to start an English school. Well, Pangna does not have, number one, a large enough population to support that, but yet he was into martial arts, and he had a martial arts studio that was self-supporting for him to be there, and that was his medium. And it's very interesting to go to that church in Phang Nga and see that about 60% are young teenage boys up through now mid-20s, people who have been his students that he's been able to disciple with Christ. So I don't think it's just English. I think any skill that you have that sometimes you can communicate can be a platform, but it's not the only. In China, that is one of the ways of going in to witness in China. And I have a lot of graduates who go to teach with ELIC. And when just a small percentage of the Chinese go to university, they realize that when every one of the students who comes to Christ is going to be a Christian leader in that country. And you do all means, as Paul would say, to reach with the gospel. I don't consider that, but it's interesting. You know, you can look at Kevin and you say vulnerable mission. You look at Steve and you say traditional mission. But partnering, working together, and I like it, the idea that some, no, not all, because I think traditional missions and vulnerable missions need to work in partners. And this is where I think we don't necessarily need a vulnerable mission society itself, although I would say the group that you're going with and Urban Partners and others are very much into being vulnerable mission. But I don't think that we don't need just vulnerable. We need to see vulnerable missions demonstrated within traditional mission agencies.
you get the impression that whenever he appears, the Africans, when the money's going to start flowing, you know, that's what they expectation. And, I wonder if we've got a cultural difference here, because you go over to the east, do you get that? You know, when they see an American face, they're wearing when the money is coming, or is there a difference of mentality? Because, you know, I know the east, people in the east tend to be very proud and self-sufficient, and I wonder if there's a difference there, or is that the same?
Well, I have no doubt that if you have a group that's being ministries and whatever are supported by finances from the outside, and the finances dry up, the groups will dry up. And that's probably why, from the very beginning, even when they started their computer school, they charged tuition. Because if people pay, they value what they receive. And it made it possible. They had one student who was actually at the university who was studying. He ran the school. He was a Thai student, was computer, but it was, I think the dependency factor would be just exactly the same. And probably that was one of the reasons why even Steve was so opposed to Noblex starting a school. Ultimately, it has proven to be successful, but it's only, by the way, he's one of seven missionaries with that mission. He's only one who is using that model. There are two who are working with the urban poor. One is working in the slums, one is just working with urban poor, and the other one is working with Karen and being an advocate for the Karen people. And I forget what the others are doing, but they're scattered and doing different types of ministry. The mission itself, it's interesting, the Baptist General Conference, Convergent International, is a Swedish Baptist denomination.
Okay. We've had a bit more time because you started late, so we'd better move on.
Thank you.
Coming all this way to tell us about this.
I will I will email you the paper and the PowerPoint slides if you'd want them, but.